So, Richard, you have a unique perspective when it comes to corruption and compliance efforts. What has that taught you about corruption in international business and how to identify and mitigate it?
Well, Pamela, thank you for the question and thank you for the opportunity to chat a little bit today. I mean, for people who work, like I did, far away from home, who are often thinly supervised, working in remote offices where, you know, sometimes it's the hotel room where you're staying that night, that's your office. And what my experience as a 10-year international sales vice president taught me the hard way, and I think what some of the challenges are today, is when it comes to anti-corruption compliance efforts and ethics programs, you know, Pamela, how does this all make sense on the front lines of international business, particularly where local cultures might appear to conflict with the rules? And, I mean, think about the environment in which people work today. Who are they talking to on a daily or weekly or quarterly basis? It's to their supervisor. It's to their regional manager. And what are they talking about? They're mostly talking about commercial objectives. They're talking about business success. They're talking about meeting their quota, their forecasts, and their bonus plan. Right? So those are the conversations that really, you know, are the ones that you'll find most among a commercial workforce. So how does a compliance program or an ethics and compliance initiative, how does that make sense as a partner to those tasks at hand? Because I think for people who are in the home offices or well-staffed and supervised regional offices, compliance doesn't look that complex, right? What are the problems here? What's not understood? Where for those who are forward-based, working in the field, it might not look so simple. It might appear to have gaps, contradictory. Maybe the compliance program and those messages which are spoken seem to conflict with sort of the unspoken messages of incentive systems. So again, I always ask from the field perspective, do anti-bribery compliance efforts and programs and initiatives, do they just look like a business partner to success? And are they geared and calibrated to the tasks at hand? So where instead of saying, okay, how do I deconflict my incentive programs and my compliance programs, where potentially people might make those decisions on their own and take compliance into their own hands, does it all look like, okay, everybody wants me successful, everybody wants me safe, I'm back home with my family, and my incentive system, my ethics and compliance training, they all speak to those same goals and messages.
Right. So it sounds like, so you just outlined some of the major struggles that organizations face when they're implementing these compliance programs and maybe oversimplifying them. Can you speak a little bit to, you've mentioned sort of how international business people can really be in a position to rationalize bribery and they're found sort of caught in this perfect storm for corruption.
Yeah, and you know, Pamela, I don't think, and I didn't, wake up in the morning and say, well, how am I going to violate the FCPA today? Or, you know, how am I going to violate international anti-bribery conventions? I mean, people are out there in the field thinking, how do I execute on my commercial objectives? And I think there's some very strong winds that can tip people in the wrong direction. And a few of these I'm going to talk about when we're together at the FIT conference. And let's remember that where these often corrupt conversations occur, which are camouflaged in many interesting and colorful words, from taking care of people to paying tolls. Recently, there was a leader at the World Bank was saying he heard a situation where the foreign bribes were called sunshine payments. Wow. I read recently where they were called chocolates, right? So these conversations and these interesting, colorful words to describe bribery, except using the word bribe, well, Pamela, they are happening all over the world in remote regions where people aren't thinking they're in the earshot of international law enforcement or their company's compliance program. So I think the first rationalization is I won't get caught. And they call that, for people who are interested in social psychology theory, they call that optimism bias. On the other side of that storm is we've got good people out there, right? People who might not jaywalk when they're back home, right? Who are good, honest, hardworking people. And I think, you know, when I'm asked, well, you know, you were basically breaking the law, conspiring to bribe people for a decade. Did you ever lose any sleep over it? And this is still tough to talk about, but I didn't because, you know, Pamela, I was ethically numb to the consequences and implications of my decisions. I wasn't spending my night on the Transparency International website, right? I wasn't thinking about how bribery and corruption robs whole societies of governance, of human rights, of social and economic development. I wasn't thinking about the consequences to my former employer, and regrettably not to myself and my family. What was I thinking about? Well, Pamela, I was thinking, who's losing here? I mean, I was in the defense business, so I wasn't pulling layers out of a bulletproof vest. The end user was always getting a world-class product. Maybe the company would have to hire a second shift or hire, you know, workers to manufacture the order. The company's happy. They get the sale. I make my quota, my forecast, my bonus. The intermediary moves on to the next sale. And the public official who, Pamela, in many parts of the world, these procurement officials are paid at poverty wages. I'm thinking, oh, okay, the public official gets a little something to make ends meet. So from the field perspective, as difficult as it is to say this, I looked at it as a win-win. Who's getting hurt here? And there's a wonderful book called Sidetracked by Professor Francesca Gino out of Harvard. And she wrote a really interesting paper that talks about how when we think our unethical actions benefit others, we come to think of them as morally acceptable and maybe even altruistic. So for me, over those 10 years, from nice business class lounges and business class travel and nice inner cities hotels and restaurants, I wasn't thinking about the wider consequences of my behavior.
Right.
And I certainly wasn't thinking, you know, when I looked at my incentive programs, which were very heavily geared to a win above all else, very many parts of the world, I thought of my commercial success as a zero-sum game to executing on my FCPA training. I looked at it as, what does management really want? All this FCPA paperwork I signed or success?
Right.
Because where I'm sitting, I can't deliver both. So those are a few things, Pamela, but just to make clear to today's readers and listeners, and we'll talk about this in Canada when I'm up there, this isn't an exercise in ethical spinning. I mean, I wasn't forced to break the law. I didn't need to bribe to be successful. And while I share these rationalizations and justifications, it's in no attempt to deflect responsibility on other people or on other organizations.
Yeah,
I wasn't a fall guy, right? So there's only one person that's responsible for Richard Bistrong going to prison, and that's Richard Bistrong. And I paid the consequences for that.
Yeah, and I think that's all really clear. And I think it's all really relatable, which is what's so interesting about your story and why it's so important to hear from people with your perspective, or even, you know, people maybe who don't have the same experience as you, but who have certainly come into contact with similar situations where they've been under pressure, where they've faced opportunities to cross a line. And I think that's why it's really important to hear from people who have been in that situation, such as yourself. Because it really provides a lot of insights into what the real challenges are there, and why you can't just say, here are the rules, don't break the rules, and everything just goes smoothly from there.
That's a great point. And let's remember, for these multinationals, for the people who write these compliance programs, well, Pamela, they're living and working in what we call the Transparency International, you know, Corruption Perception Index. They're in the green zone. But the people who are responsible for executing on commercial objectives, they're often working in the red zone. And what does this all look like from their perspective?
Yeah, I that leads really, really well into sort of looking at it from that different side of what are some of the things that organizations of all different sizes can really do to mitigate corruption within their organization and ensure that their business teams are, sort of to paraphrase something from your website, how can organizations ensure that their frontline international business teams are highly successful and rewarded while embracing an anti-bribery program?
So Pamela, the first thing is, if we look at any program, because we have change in our external environment. I mean, look at what's happening in the world right now. Countries like Brazil, you know, are going through dramatic sort of societal change. So this is not an issue that's fixed. It's ever evolving, and compliance programs need to evolve with it. So every program is going to have gaps. It's going to have weak points, and that's the whole goal is, what can compliance leaders do to lean in and to listen to get to what they don't know? Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to try to mitigate risk, who knows that better than the people that are working in the middle of it?
Right.
So what are compliance leaders doing to show themselves not only as leaders capable of rolling out a compliance program, but what about leaders who are ready to say, you know what, even with a well-intentioned program, we might get it wrong. There might be a gap. And no one would see that quicker and better than the people out in the field. So where there's a problem, come talk to us about it. Let's unpack that together. If you think that your incentive system and your forecast is pointing in a different direction of that we always care how you get the business done, in other words, the volume of getting the business done is drowning out the voice of we always care how you get the business done, don't you figure out what the company really wants? Don't you try to untangle what you might think are conflicts between commercial objectives and compliance? Talk to us about it. Don't assume anything, and let's unpack those challenges together, because if we do it together, we're going to help you. We're going to fix that problem. We're not going to put you back in the field where it's unresolved. Just don't take that decision on your own. And I think when compliance leaders can show that, I don't know, Pamela, for lack of a better word, it's like their humility or humanity or maybe vulnerability. It's really encouraging the workforce to speak up where they do think there's a problem, where they do think there's a conflict. And when you have, I guess, each side is the other's ambassadors, right, where compliance leaders feel that they are the champions for the commercial workforce to make sure they're always well-trained and they understand what their risks are and that compliance is there to keep them successful and safe. And the people in the commercial workforce, they think of themselves as compliance ambassadors as well. Then those weak points are always getting mitigated and they're always getting raised up and addressed. So I think, you know, from a communication standpoint, that's critical.
Okay, that's great. I think that brings me right up to the next thing I want to talk about too, which is whistleblowers. So do you think it's important, I think you do, from the sounds of it, to empower potential whistleblowers within an organization? And do you think that organizations are doing this successfully today?
Let's talk about it, whistleblowing in a wider sense, okay? So, you know, Pamela, it takes a village to deliver international goods or services. Like, think about all the people involved. You have sales order processing. You have people in logistics. You have people in accounts receivable that are, you know, and in finance and accounts payable. And let's think of people that are sort of wide in the org chart and deep in the org chart. These are people on the factory floor. These are people, you know, in sales order processing. And I always like to ask, do these people, no matter where they are, feel like they are a part of the ethics and compliance team? So if someone gets a piece of paperwork, even if it's by their supervisor, and something doesn't look right, they said, you know what, I've never seen a sample order this large, or I've never seen a credit like this before. Do they feel empowered to hit the pause button and to say, I need to speak up about this? Or do they feel like they're just a small gear in a large machine and they're paid to process the paperwork and this came from my supervisor? Who am I to make issue of this? So I think it's more than just whistleblowing. It's like courageous conversations to talk about problems where you see them. And some recent surveys have demonstrated that people down in the org chart don't feel like they're compliance ambassadors. And they are such a wonderful ethics and compliance resource. So I think compliance leaders really need to think holistically about all the people who might touch international goods and services when they think about their anti-bribery compliance efforts, just like they need to encourage people in the commercial workforce, like we were talking about, to speak up when they see an issue. And even to the point where they can say, you know what? If you do speak up and you hear that we're upset, that actually means it's a good conversation because you're sharing something with us and we're fixing a problem together. So I think companies have a long way to go to really encouraging that in a more, I think, wider sense than just whistleblowing.
Yeah, and it sounds like that would have to originate and really permeate the entire sort of company culture.
That's exactly right. That has to go wide and it has to go deep in an organization to people who are all in the same company, but they're not necessarily on the same team organizationally. They're in different divisions. It has to span support functions.
Right. So maybe the best place for us to sort of wrap up our conversation today is to talk about what resources are out there that can really help organizations of all sizes set up successful compliance programs.
Well, Pamela, there are so many of them. I mean, there's such a proliferation of publicly sourced material that's out there. There's wonderful video interviews out there. You know, we have compliance organizations that offer certifications. So I don't think there's any single source of information, but in a way that's a good thing because there's so much data and thought leadership out there that it's a little bit overwhelming right now. So compliance leaders really need to function on where they think their program needs a little bit of support, and then to sort of do the online searches, ask within their networks to what the best sources of that information might be.
Right, and really take advantage of those on the front line within their organization.
It's such a, I mean, that's the wonderful part about how much the whole compliance field has evolved right now, is that there's really some wonderful, incredible thought leadership. And Pamela, it's one of the things that I love about the work that I do now is it's anything but static. It's changing, and it's getting richer and deeper year by year.
Yeah, that's so great. Well, Richard, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today about this. I think it's so great to hear from people who have different perspectives on this and who've really been involved and are watching the whole thing evolve and giving people tools and organizations tools to really tackle these, you know, often really complicated issues. So we're really, really looking forward to hearing you talk about these issues and others at the Your Future in Global Markets conference in October. And thanks so much for doing this.
Oh, it's a pleasure. And, you know, our panel is going to be really interesting. We've got Christine Robidoux, who has experience now. She's in-house, and she was also external counsel. She had involvement in some really interesting anti-bribery cases in Canada. We've got Sergeant Potvin from the RCMP and my perspective. So I think we're going to have a lot of different parts of this and perspectives from this issue up in Ottawa. So I am super excited about seeing you up there.
Yeah, it's going to be a great session and a great event. Thanks, Richard.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thank you.